Welcome to the Speaker's Corner Show. This week's show was recorded at my own meeting. You can visit our website at speakerscorner.net, or you can tune in every Friday at 2:30 p.m. or every Sunday at 4:30 p.m. to our show on 104.4 Resonance FM.
Gentlemen, you asked me why Haiti and the Haitians are in such a terrible condition. And really, you always have to look at the history of a place to understand why something that suddenly occurs there, if it's a natural disaster, an economic disaster, a war, a revolution, what the origin of this is. And with Haiti, you really have to look at the history of Haiti. And if you look at that, you'll discover the reason why Haiti is, as they describe, the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. And it is from this poverty that all the other consequences follow, that when a natural disaster hits, that the people are on the edge of annihilation. And really, if you look at a little bit about Haitian history, you'll see one of the reasons, it's almost a sort of illustration of some of the viciousness of capitalism or of imperialism, its modern incarnation, that Haiti was always mistreated precisely because it was the first slave rebellion state.
The
first slave rebellion state. It rose up in revolution after the French Revolution and attempted to establish slave-based revolutionary state. And since that time, it has always been mistreated. In fact, when the Spanish occupied, originally, Columbus went there on one of his first expeditions. When they occupied Haiti, it was considered to be the jewel in the crown of the Caribbean. It was actually the richest colony that they had, producing coffee, sugar, and indigo, I believe it is. And so, to turn a country that was naturally, I mean, this is in the Caribbean, these countries are naturally well endowed with the fruits of life. And yet, they are turned into their exact opposite, into colonized, plundered, exploited people, where most of the population live on less than $2 a day, where half of the wealth of the country belongs to 1% of the population, and where the usual pattern of exploitation, imperialist intervention, poverty, hunger, unemployment, half the population are unemployed, and all these processes combined together with a natural disaster create absolute chaos and catastrophe, which you can contrast with, I ask you to contrast with two other incidents. One would be the regularity of hurricanes in Cuba and the way in which the Cubans are able to respond to this destruction caused by natural disasters. And the other would be the intervention of the Chinese army last year during the Sichuan earthquake, which had similar characteristics, but at the same time they were able to deal with it. And within a year, everybody who'd lost their housing in the Sichuan disaster was rehoused. They built houses, I believe it was 15,000 a week at one time, they were building houses. So it illustrates the distinction between the ability of a society which is dominated by planning and a society which is dominated by chaos and the complete control of market economics, and then added to that, compounding that, the control of imperialism. And of course, it's not just the Spanish who are involved. The Spanish invaded Haiti, slaughtered the indigenous population. The French invaded Haiti, slaughtered the indigenous population. The British invaded Haiti, slaughtered the indigenous population. And the Spanish invaded Haiti and slaughtered the indigenous population. The last invader, of course, or better said, last century, they were invaded by the Americans until, what was it, 1934? 15 to 34, something like that. Then in more recent times, when they elected in the 1980s, elected a leader who stood up for their rights, Aristide, then of course the Americans went in and overthrew that government. And then a couple of years later, they overthrew the government that they'd installed by sending in the army, I believe it was again. Then they sent in the United Nations to take over their army, to take over the country. So in other words, it's one of those countries where you can almost say they were punished for rebelling against imperialism, and then they were, as you say, raped endlessly. And even today, I remember going to New York a couple of years ago, and unlike in London, where you go through the very cheap marketplaces, you buy things for a pound or 50 pence or three for a pound or something, and everything's labelled made in China, made in Bangladesh, made in Thailand. In the United States of America, everything of a pound in the pound shops or the dollar shops or three for a dollar t-shirts, they're all made in Haiti. And so you get an idea about the background to understand why, when an earthquake hits, everything in that society collapses. If an earthquake level 7 hit Los Angeles or San Francisco, there would be a few people dead. Not 100,000 or more, as they are claiming at the moment. And again, precisely because America's on the doorstep, you can see the chaos which follows from American style intervention. Because we had this last a couple of years ago with the Los Angeles, New Orleans disaster. The United States itself was incapable of dealing with such an issue. And then we have on the doorstep, Haiti is the plundered baby on the doorstep of the United States of America. Again, this disaster is allowed to run rife without the slightest serious intervention to resolve the problem of the masses in this area, which illustrates the way the world is subdivided and controlled. Does that answer your question? Well, there you go. You see, you become Pavlov's dog at my meeting.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I like the challenge.
In Palestine, in spite of all these Hamas groups and whatever, I found out that there is only 7% Marxist or leftist. 7%. And yet, they are obsessed anti-Americans. You know, all of them, they're very anti-American. But why the amount of Marxist culture, Marxist view, is so minimal in a country that is in the battlefield of defeating the American enemy?
Well, again, this is a historical background. It's impossible for me to come to Speaker's Corner and speak under a red flag or in the name of Marxism without people shouting at me during the course of the afternoon. It was tried and failed in the Soviet Union, and therefore your ideas are finished. And that, of course, is a very powerful argument. It's based on powerful historical facts.
Yeah.
And that undermined the position of Marxists and left-wingers who, within the Palestinian movement and many other social and nationalist movements in the Middle East, adopted a left-wing position for nationalization, state intervention, the domination of the public sector over the private, the domination of the interests of the masses over the interests of the capitalists. And therefore what you had was, after the collapse of Stalinism, you had the rebirth of various forms of nationalism, not only inside the former Soviet bloc, but across the entire planet.
Yeah.
You had that as an identity, which was an alternative means of fighting against the larger nation states and the more powerful nation states, whose economic domination was palpable to see, but which could not be, or appeared not to be able to be challenged by a working class movement that would seek to bring about socialist change. And therefore what you had instead of that was a twist towards nationalism, and alongside nationalism, towards religious fundamentalism. So on the one side you have the rebirth of radical Islam, of fundamentalist Islam, and the other side you had the rebirth of nationalist movements that believe almost exclusively in this national identity. You had this in it, don't forget, it wasn't exclusive to Palestine. Look at the former Soviet Union and the areas associated with it. You had the complete breakup of Yugoslavia, the creation of new national identities. I'm Croatian, I'm Bosnian, I'm Kosovan, I'm Moldovan, I'm Tajiki, Kazakh, Azerbaijani,
Armenian.
Okay, Kurdish you had before, Lithuanian, Latvian, you know. There are dozens and dozens of national identities that have emerged out of the former Soviet Union alone. Added to that, you've had the same type of processes developing in other areas of the world, like the Middle East and Africa, which in some respects, in some places, still has some progressive core, like in Palestine. Actually, underneath it all, without resolving the class question, who owns and controls the banks, insurance, finance, and the economy, ultimately decides the fate of the masses. And that, if you like, has been proven by the events of the last year or 2 years, where the world economy has illustrated its domination over all the fate of mankind. In a way that many people had believed was unlikely ever to happen again, because capitalism was supposedly economically triumphant and able to solve all the problems of mankind. Now we see that capitalism has entered a profound period of crisis in which questioning about its social, its economic and social structure will become eventually a much more powerful ideological force. But human beings react to events generally rather than act in advance of events. That is why, in a way, Haiti is an exception, because in the 19th century, when they rose up as the first slave rebellion, they were an exception, a peculiar exception to the rule of history. In fact, slavery continued throughout the Caribbean for a long period of time, and eventually the Haitians had to pay indemnity for the money for the fact that they had freed themselves from slavery. I think it was to the French.
So there is also another factor, in particularly in the Palestinian case. The working class is almost non-existent. They are all small traders, you see. That is definitely a big blow to Marxism.
This is a very important point. Capitalism, at least according to the theory which Marx originally developed, was supposed to expand itself, to reach its tentacles to the whole world, and to transform petty production, peasant production, and small-scale trading into large-scale operations and combine them all together, and thereby lay the foundation, technically and economically, for the creation of a new form of social organization, which large-scale combination would lay the foundation for global cooperation between working people. The creation of a unified economy and a unified society under genuine democracy. And so many countries have been held backwards and therefore are compelled to reenact events that have happened elsewhere in the world, but in new guises.
So this criminally insane militarization of the world then is unstoppable if the world is still politically so backward.
The militarization of the world, of course, has purposes. And the purposes are expansion, prestige, power. And therefore, it also is limited by economic contingencies inside the most powerful capitalist countries. Having said that, of course, each country that rises tries to proclaim its own military authority and seeks to establish its own elite, which is capable of maintaining power over its own people and also of extending that power to other subordinate nations or countries that are essential to its raw materials, resources, and maintenance of the power and prestige of the ruling class of that country. So, for example, Pakistan develops a nuclear bomb, supposedly to defend itself against the threat from India. Each country, even the poorest countries, spend vast amounts of money on weapons, armory, and so on. One, to control their own people, and two, to try and, if necessary, challenge external forces, which might, for example, I don't know, raise the price of oil. You know, if one country, you're next door to Nigeria, that raise the price of oil, you want to be able to say, okay, this oil field actually is in disputed territory and belongs to us. And so, you know, you have the endless cycle under capitalism of the struggle for markets, the struggle for prestige, the struggle for power, and militarization, which is a direct consequence of these struggles. Unless you bend over backwards and accept the rule of imperialism unfettered and unhindered, which of course no ruling class is prepared to do. Because it's one thing, I open a shop over here, you know, selling newspapers, and I'm on my own. If next door there's only a limited market, and next door someone opens up a shop selling the same thing, you know, we hate each other, even if it's my brother.
The thing is that Pakistan and India are still a subject to getting aid from the UK, Republican, while they're spending their money on armaments.
Well, we're often told how much aid this country gives, and they very rarely compare the aid figures with the trade figures. So what we receive in terms of trade from many countries in the world, I can't give you the figures for Pakistan, but my guess would be that would be the case. If you like, conceals behind it some of the aid, and often the aid is subject to certain conditions. For example, you might remember the case with Margaret Thatcher, where they went to Malaysia, they offered aid to build a dam, but the contract was appointed, I believe, to a British company. And so it's often the case that aid is a concealment for a particular, that's right, whereby you, I give you money to do something as long as you employ me to do it. And so often it's a concealment. Not that British people don't believe they are giving aid, they are giving aid. The problem lies in that the global trade relations are so rigged that even when you give aid to a country, actually because of the way the world is organized, for example, let's say you give aid to Haiti after the disaster, and they build a brand new tower, a brand new deep water port in Port-au-Prince. But what will happen, of course, is that from Port-au-Prince they will export goods to England or America or France, and because Port-au-Prince doesn't have the power to determine terms of trade, whatever they export, let's say sugar or coffee, will be bought at prices determined by London. And in that way, you can rob the people even though you help them. By helping them, you help to rob them. After all, look at the case of the last few years. Banks were giving money out hand over fist to everybody. You could borrow money hand over fist. But now many of those people who borrowed that money have realized it was a poison chalice, because they weren't only giving you money, they were also asking you to pay them money over and above what they lent you, considerably over and above. And the assets which you purchased with that money, which they lent you happily on the basis that the prices were going up and you're making a good investment, the assets suddenly began to collapse. They end up owning your house, which you paid them so they could own it. And that's the case now. Look how many people now in Britain are threatened with losing their house.
They don't kick you out in Cuba. They own the banks.
And then some people ask, well, why are people so conservative now? Well, it was an interesting figure, just in terms of personal terms, an interesting figure given a couple of weeks ago in the newspapers, where they said, I believe it was nearly 1 million people between the age of 25 and 45 have moved back with their mum.
Yeah.
No, 35 and 45, and around the same figure for 25 to 35 who haven't moved out of home.
You can't get rid of them.
So that's a we have an empirical verification. And of course, that creates a certain conservatism. It creates a type of the type of society that was traditionally associated with Italy, Greece, and Spain, where the welfare state is no longer the relevant thing for independent young individuals. Instead of this, you go back to your parents and rely upon them to help you out.
Yeah.
And of course, that it fosters a certain conservatism.
Well, if you go back to the UK, say 1900, families were all living in two rooms, several generations.
Perfectly correct.
Yeah.
In fact, the tendency over the long term was the dissolution of that and the creation of the separate nuclear family, where, you know, grandparents lived in one town, parents in another, and children in the other. Now, of course, they're beginning to have the reverse. But this is the social consequence, which there are many psychological consequences associated with, of this economic crisis of capitalism. And so there are, even though there are many, many things which are not determined by the crisis of capitalism, everybody's independent thought at this minute, of course, is not determined by the crisis of capitalism. But the foundational parameters within which we operate as human beings are determined by the need to produce and reproduce life as it is. And the fact of the matter is, the way in which we do that, the mode of production which we live under, which governs that process, is the mode of production of capitalism. And until such time as that mode of production is overthrown, and a system of democratic control of the commanding heights of the biggest companies in the world is established, then we will forever be in this cyclical process of expansion and contraction. Expansion and contraction, in which suddenly we make progress and some people advance and some people get rich and some people do okay, and then we are thrown backwards and society suddenly turns in on itself and the progress which we make, the advances we make, are reversed. That's why the idea of socialism is not to create a perfect utopia on earth, but to lay the foundation for stability and planning on a social level and on an individual level, so that you can, a child can turn around and say, I'd like to do this, and they would be able, maybe, if their abilities are relevant and connected with their desires, maybe to realize their objective to do the type of tasks, to fulfill their creativity, to use their skills in a way that corresponds with their desires, rather than being cogs in a machine to extract surplus wealth from the unpaid labour of working people, which is the way the world is organised today. That's a very simple fact.
How do you see the idea of recession? We've been through what we call a recession in the last 18 months, say, but record sales in a lot of the shops. Blue Water's been full nearly every week. I went to the cinema last night. We had difficulty parking, and there's restaurants there with people. This so-called recession, compared with, say, the 1920s and 30s recession, no comparison, unless it's in specific little areas. That's all I can say.
The 1930s were a different phenomenon to what we've got today. There are, however, similarities.
Same name, recession.
World trade fell, I believe, by nearly as much in the last couple of years as it did in the Great Depression. However, we have a globalized entity today. So you see one country, the richest countries in particular, they suffer less economically than many other countries would suffer. Some countries will suffer catastrophic collapses, such as, for example, Ireland, Iceland,
Ukraine,
Spain, funnily enough, 20% unemployed, 25% unemployment already there, huge collapse in property prices, mass unemployment, and a sudden transformation from an expanding, booming economy to a depressed crisis economy. Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania,
Ukraine
in particular, Ukraine, a very severe economic crisis. Yeah. Much of Russia is in desperate economic crisis. Much of the Caribbean, parts of the United States, parts of Britain actually. But again, it depends on where you are. In some areas where there was late expansion, in other words, where the boom reached, for example, Liverpool or Manchester or Preston or Derby, let's say 2 years ago or 3 years ago, suddenly that's collapsed again.
Yeah.
And so it was the case in the United States in the 1930s, even in the Great Depression from 29 to 33, that in New York and Philadelphia, they did all right. Was actually another other areas of the country that are catastrophic unemployment. The Dust Bowl areas, central United States, southern United States, they suffered more during the Great Depression than the northern areas of the United States. So there are contradictory processes taking place in the world and uneven processes taking place in the world. Combined with this process of global economic slowdown, in some countries severe depression, in other countries more light recession, within some countries greater economic crisis in one region as opposed to another region, that's particularly the case in Britain, then you also have a global transformation in power relations that will have profound consequences economically and politically in the next 5 or 10 years.
Sure.
the rise of China, the decline of the United States, the decline of much of Europe. These processes will explode, will have explosive consequences in terms of power relations again. Germany is the dominant power within Europe. How much is its power increased by in an economic recession such as we've seen in the last year or two? Germany was the big exporter of high-end products, the biggest exporter in the world. It was just overtaken last week, according to statistics, by China for the first time. So in other words, the biggest exporter in the world, the biggest trade power now in the world is probably the People's Republic of China. So we are seeing a global transformation in power relations within the Great Recession. Just as we saw in the 1920s coming into 1930s, the transformation in power relations from Europe, based around Britain, to the United States during the period of the Great Depression. And then following the Second World War, which interrupted that or concealed that process, then the United States emerged completely dominant by 1945. And Britain was the second or third rate power immediately after the Second World War. Yeah. But don't forget, in 1933 or not even 1925, 26, Britain was the number one power on earth. And of course, the consequences of the collapse of British power were the rise of colonial revolts. Again, coming back to this question about nationalism, anti-imperialism, which grew out of the Second World War and of the economic crisis that happened before that. We are in a period which will probably lead, I was discussing with one of the leading Marxist economists the other day, and he said, we are in a period of slight upturn in the economy. There will be another economic downturn. It may be as sharp or sharper than the one we just experienced, around 2 or 3 or 4 years' time. And then there will be a prolonged period of expansion, starting from a lower level again, because capitalists invest on the basis that it is cheap enough to invest profitably.
That was the Speaker's Corner show for this week. Come down to Speaker's Corner any Sunday afternoon and join us to speak, listen or discuss. Tune in every Friday at 2:30 p.m. on 104.4 Resonance FM, or visit our website, speakerscorner.net, that's speakerscorner.net.